Next case on our call is agenda number 8, number 130033, Terrence Laverly versus the Department of Financial and Professional Regulation. Counsel for the appellant, are you here to proceed?
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, Your Honors, may it please the Court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Evan Siegel on behalf of the Illinois Department of Professional Financial Regulation. Your Honors, this Court should reverse the appellate court's decision, which departs from this Court's longstanding jurisprudence about sovereign immunity on three distinct grounds. First, nowhere in Section 15 of the Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities Confidentiality Act is there a waiver of sovereign immunity in the provision of attorney fees and costs and that allows the receipt of attorney fees and costs after a procedure like this pursuant to 740 ILCS 110/1 and sec. Now, the appellate court did not address this aspect of the act, but at essence here is the language of Section 15. That is to say, we are faced with a statutory question, and the usual starting point in such cases is the statute. Now, apart from the statutory language of Section 15, the appellate court did improperly conclude in two parts. First, the officer suit exception to sovereign immunity applies to a forward-looking injunctive type remedy, which attorney fees and costs in no sense are. And third, the appellate court improperly failed to recognize that the plaintiffs did not identify an individual, an actual person, not the department itself, who acted illegally beyond the scope of his or her authority. And if the court does not have a different preference, I will address these issues in order. First, as to the statutory language, this court has long held for nearly a century that a statute must expressly indicate in affirmative language the General Assembly's intent to waive sovereign immunity. Not only that, the waiver must be clear and unequivocal. The provision at issue here, Section 15 of the Act, contains no such affirmative, clear, and unequivocal waiver of sovereign immunity. Indeed, nowhere in Section 15 is the state even mentioned. And that stands in direct contrast to other statutes that do waive sovereign immunity explicitly. Nor does Section 15 meet the standard that this court set forth in Parmar versus Madigan, that a statute cannot use only general terms. It must instead contain an expressed intent to subject the state to liability. Now, with both of these tenets in mind, it's impermissible, also under the plain language analysis that this court employs in analyzing statutes and sovereign immunity principles, to read into the presence, into the statute rather, the presence of language that is not there itself. And it's just not there in Section 15. Instead, that provision states only that, quote, reasonable attorney's fees and costs may be awarded to the successful plaintiff in any action under this act. Again, it doesn't say anything about a successful plaintiff versus a defendant who is a state actor. If the state is a defendant, no attorney fees or costs are available due to basic principles of sovereign immunity. By contrast, there are, of course, statutes, again, not an issue here, that contain the affirmative, clear, and unequivocal waiver of sovereign immunity. One example is the Illinois Educational Labor Relations Act. And it states that, quote, for purposes of this act, the state of Illinois waives sovereign immunity. Likewise, the Illinois Toll Highway Toll Highway Act provides that the state of Illinois hereby consents to certain suits against the authority. But it does not follow the plaintiffs insist that we can glean in Section 15, an affirmative, clear, and unequivocal legislative intent to waive sovereign immunity. To discern that, this court would have to abandon its principle that exceptions, conditions, or limitations that the legislature did not express cannot be read into the statute that contravenes this court's principles. So in short, the absence of any statutory waiver here compels, is evident, and it compels the conclusion that the General Assembly did not intend to waive our state's immunity in this fees and costs provisions. Now moving on from the statutory issue, this court should also conclude that the appellate court incorrectly decided the officer suit exception issue. And there are two distinct problems here. Each one supplies an independently sufficient basis to reverse the appellate court. First, the officer suit exception applies only if a plaintiff seeks to enjoin future conduct alleged to be contrary to law. As this court recently stated earlier this year, its Walker decision, future conduct or forward-looking relief is the key. But monies that are to be expended to pay for past wrongs do not count. And right here, the plaintiff's claims for attorney's fees collapses. Attorney fees and costs are backwards-looking.
But counsel, your opponent says, well, yeah, but this is all ancillary. It's all related. So, attorney's fees are paid, and that perhaps that will help, be part of the enforcement of prohibited future conduct.
Well, that's just incorrect, Your Honor, on a couple of different bases. Attorney fees are not available in so many civil remedies statutes in Section 740 ILCS of the Code, for instance. And yet, dozens of suits are brought in this state daily, some component of which are seeking injunctive relief. It's hard to believe that a provision for attorney's fees, as the appellate court implied in its decision, is necessary and part and parcel of the injunctive relief itself. That is a required incentive for somebody to vindicate their rights in this manner. And there's a line of cases that we have cited where, by distinction, the monetary recovery, the attorney fees, one of them perhaps, but more to the general point, the payment itself is the order, it is the injunction. And so the appellate court's decision in Wilson that involved a stipend that the governor did not believe had to be paid, when the court ordered it paid, the stipend itself was ancillary, that is, it facilitated, it was part and parcel, inextricably intertwined with the order. That's not what we have here, because no one is compelled to seek fees. There may be parties under this act who obtain a protective order, they never seek fees. When it's private party versus private party, it's not compelled or required, they're separate and distinct. And it's not forward-looking relief, because such fees compensate an attorney and his or her firms for work they did in the past. Indeed, when a circuit court considers a fee petition, it's looking at work done and accounted for and billed. It's not a future-looking order of a lump sum. That would be nice for the plaintiff's bar, but you don't get paid in advance for work under attorney fee provisions. And this court has implicitly held that this is the nature of attorney fees in its state ex rel Shad versus MyPillow case, where the court held that a prevailing party's lawyers for work performed at the successful conclusion of litigation could be compensated. Again, not forward-looking. Even if plaintiff's claims for attorney fees could be correctly characterized as a present claim to address a past wrong, that characterization fails this court's distinction between present and past claims and future claims. Our present claim also is not forward-looking and does not invoke the officer suit exception to sovereign immunity. Finally, on this point, as Your Honor mentioned, ancillary is just a moniker that the plaintiffs and the appellate court have seized upon, but it's a non-starter because, as I mentioned, you don't have to get fees. It's optional. People can recover without them. So there's no inextricable connection between the one, the fees, and the order itself, the protective order in this case. Indeed, in this court's decision in Litaru, the plaintiff, student at the University of Illinois, obtained an injunction, a forward-looking order to prohibit state actors and individuals at the university from interfering with his due process rights. It didn't follow under the statutes at issue there, certainly not automatically, that because he obtained an injunctive order that he was then entitled to attorney fees. So this forward-looking issue is an independent basis permitting this court to hold that the officer suit exception does not apply in this case. But even if this court does determine that there's a forward-looking aspect to attorney fees, the plaintiffs fail to meet the second threshold requirement of the officer suit exception. And that's an allegation that the state officer's conduct either violates the law or exceeds his or her duties. The act has to be, in essence, ultra vires, something egregious. Before we consider the illegal conduct itself, which actually really hasn't been alleged in the amended complaint, this is a fatal flaw to the plaintiff's argument, one they have yet to address, but maybe we'll hear about in a moment. They haven't identified the actor, the individual. Who is it? Who is the single person of record whom they allege acted beyond his or her authority or illegally? And nor did the appellate court directly identify this critical but mysteriously missing person. If that individual does not
exist... Counsel, didn't the appellate court in this case agree with the Gray case in that they said just because money... a successful action will cause money to be paid from the state's treasury doesn't mean that the state is the actor against whom the action was brought. I mean, the court tried to make that distinction. Isn't that right?
The court did try to make that distinction, Your Honor. Gray is an anomaly, and there is a separate case in the First District Appellate Court that the Appellate Court did not follow called Shemp.
Well, there are two cases. One, Shemp says one thing and yes. Gray says another, and the Appellate Court in this case decided to follow Gray. So yes. I guess the Appellate Court thought that Shemp was the anomaly.
Correct, Your Honor. The problem with Gray, one of the problems with Gray, is that it relies on the Fifth District's case in Wilson, which I discussed a moment ago. But Wilson differs from our case, and arguably from Gray, because the money that the state would pay, that the state would be required to pay in Wilson.
Well, counsel, isn't the appellate, respond to the appellate court's comment in this case. It says the ancillary award of fees is necessary to make it practicable for citizens to assert a claim to stop a state actor from illegal conduct. Can you respond to that? Is that a legitimate concern? And, you know, was the appellate court incorrect in saying that?
The appellate court was correct in two different regards. First, as to your initial question, Justice Cunningham, it's contrary to this court's 90 years of precedent to hold that payment from the state doesn't necessarily violate the precepts of sovereign immunity. That's the purpose of sovereign immunity. That holding is anomalous and inconsistent with this court's jurisprudence. As to your question about whether the payment of fees is ancillary or part and parcel of the fee award, it's not, because it's optional to seek fees. And there are many, many statutes in the civil code that do not contain fee shifting requirements. And yet, we follow in this state the American rule, whereby plaintiffs, by and large, are responsible for the cost of litigation. So the appellate court, in some ways, was rewriting.
Well, what about the practicality of citizens exercising their right to stop illegal conduct by someone who is purporting to act on behalf of the state?
And your question is whether or not, in that instance, attorney fees should follow from the issuance of an injunction?
I'm just saying, isn't it part and parcel of the whole action?
No, it's not necessarily part and parcel of any action for declaratory or injunctive relief, because there are many statutes that don't provide it, that the general, where the General Assembly did see fit to create a fee award for the successful plaintiff who prevails against a private defendant. So we disagree with that ancillary characterization. Returning to the problem with the failure to identify an individual, only a person can do the things that the appellate court seized upon under this court's longstanding sovereign immunity line of cases. The department is not a person, cannot be the actor who acts egregiously in violation of the law or exceeds specific individual duties.
So but you're saying that the that an individual or the lawyer should have been named or somebody named in their individual capacity?
I'm not saying.
Because they didn't, then they don't get the party gets no attorney's fees. Is that what you're saying?
In part. Let me unpack it. I'm not saying that the department's attorney should have been named because she did anything wrong, but in line with this court's longstanding precedent, putting aside the whole
thing in the Taro. Under these facts, someone was insisting that the notes be turned over when it became, I think the term that was used, dogged determination, when it became clear that the notes probably weren't discoverable. Are you saying that that person should or should not have been the person that was named?
It would have been very easy to name an individual affiliated with the department. Justice Caleb Litaru named both the Board of Trustees and also an assistant vice chancellor as defendant. The department's leadership is not a secret. It's posted on a website. We can all figure out who the director is. And on the website, as I looked the other day, many different division directors. I'm not in the habit of suggesting that my clients be sued, but it would have been quite simple to name an individual. We still don't.
So under that scenario, what would happen to the attorney's fees issue?
In that scenario, there would have had to have been allegations of egregious ultra vires wrongdoing, not simply an adjudicated adversarial proceeding to determine whether a protective order should have been issued, but on the surface, the requirement of naming an individual would have been satisfied. Whether or not there could have been claims of wrongdoing under the officer suit exception is speculative, but that did not happen here. And so because there was no identified wrongdoing individual, the officer suit exception does not apply. And just to highlight what the appellate court said in this regard, the appellate court attributed human characteristics to an agency. You already alluded to that, Justice Cunningham. The appellate court held that, quote, the department knew that the documents might be privileged, resisted the plaintiff's efforts to settle that question, and doggedly persisted in its demand for their production. That's in the appellate court's decision, paragraph 42. Only people can act this way, not inanimate, inert departments and agencies. In short, the officer suit exception does not apply, and no amendments can cure its essential, the complaint's essential fatal defects at this point. There is no basis to remand this case for amendment.
And it couldn't be cured by adding the director of the department in his official capacity or something that could, that would not cure it?
Well, it would not cure it based on my understanding of the record, because we haven't heard, seen, or gleaned from the record what the director of the department did in violation of his duties. It's not simply that there are two things that have to happen, Your Honor. An individual must be named, and the complaint must allege the extra-legal, egregious acts by an individual. Your Honors, I see my time is up. I will be back on rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Rick Schoenfield. Excuse me. And I represent the plaintiffs, appellees in this case. First, obviously, the department can only act through its individual officers and employees. Would it have made a difference in this case if we had named one? No. The case would have proceeded as it did. The fact is, there was an improper demand for privileged documents. The department, finally at oral argument, conceded that they should have agreed to an oral argument in the appellate court, at last conceded they should have agreed to an in-camera inspection instead of resisting it every step of the way. Had they done that, we would not be here.
So that's, could I focus on that for a moment? I think everyone would agree that the key here is, have you pled and shown that there was an unlawful and without legal authority action by the department, right? Those are the terms of art that we use, unlawful and without legal authority. So here, department lawyers in an adversarial hearing before the administrative law judge made an argument that the act did not apply to these documents. And obviously you or someone on behalf of the other side argued that the act did apply. The ALJ agreed with the lawyers for the department. And then another action was filed in the circuit court, and the circuit court disagreed with the finding of the ALJ and instead found that the act did apply to these documents. So if we're looking for, I'm asking you, what was the unlawful or without legal authority action by the department? Are you saying that making a unsuccessful argument in a contested hearing is unlawful?
I'm saying that making an argument that is clearly contrary to the law to demand that documents in which a privilege has been claimed should be turned over without an in-camera inspection, that violates this statute. That is what the circuit court and the appellate court found.
Who makes that decision? What? Who makes a decision of whether or not these documents come within the act? A judge, right? An ALJ or a judge sitting in the circuit court of Cook County. That's who makes that decision, right?
No, Your Honor. The judge did not say that the documents did not come within the act. The judge made up his own rule that you had to provide an affidavit in support of your claim that a document was privileged. I've been doing
this. Circuit court disagreed with the ALJ.
Well, and I think
what I'm saying is, what is unlawful about a lawyer making an argument in a contested hearing that is later shown, or later another higher court determines was that claim was unsuccessful? Why is that unlawful?
Because the statute says so. This is not a matter, this isn't even a matter of a common law privilege. This is a matter of the legislature passing a statute which says that these therapist notes are privileged. And privileged in specifically, among other places, in administrative hearings. And further providing that a violation of the statute, if it aggrieves parties in the case, entitles them to relief, including attorney's fees, which I will discuss, which are ancillary relief. And so
the department itself, unlawful,
yes.
I mean, that's a pretty strong word, unlawful act here, that there apparently is some controversy on this issue, since the ALJ ruled one way and the circuit court ruled a different way. So there's some controversy here.
What the court ruled, circuit court and then the appellate court, was that there was a duty on the part of the department not to be making a claim that was clearly illegal. The ALJ, as I said, made up his own procedure that simply asserting a privilege was insufficient. It had been asserted from the stand to begin with by Mr. Lavery while under oath. He didn't say it in exactly an articulate legal manner, but he asserted that these were his notes.
But it says in the appellate court you conceded, you're not saying the ALJ acted unlawfully, even though you're saying this decision was made up by the ALJ. You're not saying that the actions of the ALJ was unlawful. It was the lawyers arguing on behalf of the department that were unlawful. Is that right?
We did not bring a claim against the ALJ and start dealing with issues of judicial immunity. What he did was actually improper and unlawful, but that's not our case. Our case is that the department, by pursuing these documents, was violating the statute. And the legislature obviously was concerned to stop parties from trying to obtain these privileged documents in violation of the statute. Otherwise, the legislature would not have created the statute, which number one said they're privileged in all of these various proceedings, which include proceedings where the state is obviously going to be involved. And two, that it went beyond just saying they're privileged. It then said if a party is aggrieved by a violation, the party is entitled to relief, including, my word, ancillary attorney's fees. If it wasn't for the statute, we would not be here. If this was a common law privilege, we would not be here because there's no provision for this kind of relief. But here, this is based upon the legislature's passing this particular statute. And what's the point of it saying that if a party is aggrieved by a violation, it's entitled to money damages, which we're not claiming, which would be a different case, and attorney's fees and costs? It did that to stop people from trying to obtain privileged documents, including, and they don't contest this, state administrative hearings, state legislative hearings, state judicial hearings, and the state they don't contest is subject, the department here, is subject to honoring that privilege. They have no right to breach that privilege. And when it went to an in-camera inspection, every document we submitted was deemed to be privileged. Did they argue that was wrong? No. Did they appeal that was wrong? No. Did they appeal that the finding that my clients were aggrieved by a statutory violation was wrong? No. So they have no right to be even arguing that here. Did they appeal that there was no, so their argument that no illegal conduct has been changed? What? They have no right to do that. There was a finding. There was a judgment against them. They did not appeal that part of the judgment. They did not appeal that finding that my clients were aggrieved by a statutory violation. The only thing they brought up when they brought the appeal was sovereign immunity. Their argument has been blossoming and expanding in this court. If I may, quickly let me just mention, I find it surprising that counsel did not mention they're asking you to overturn your decision in Leetaru, which goes to their argument about individuals. Would it matter? Would this case have proceeded in the same way if I'd named the director? Yes. If I'd named the lawyer? Yes. If I'd named someone who the lawyer was in communication with? Yes. We'd be in the same place. Now, as to the issue of ancillary, counsel's argument really does not comport with the intrinsic nature of ancillary relief as it has been treated for years by courts in Illinois. There's a string of appellate court cases in our brief which say statutory attorney's fees are ancillary relief. There's also a Supreme Court case, Fireball versus McGovern, we cited, which says that ancillary relief does not create a cause of action. This is a critical point. Ancillary relief does not create subject matter jurisdiction. Why is this so important? Because sovereign immunity, which is what this appeal is supposed to be about, sovereign immunity blocks subject matter jurisdiction. Therefore, I submit to you that since ancillary relief has nothing to do with subject matter jurisdiction, the subject matter jurisdiction in this case stems from the violation of the statute in seeking the privileged documents, sovereign immunity cannot have any application to ancillary relief, because while sovereign immunity blocks subject matter jurisdiction, ancillary relief is not where the subject matter jurisdiction comes from. The Rodriguez case that this court decided, while not exactly on point, is instructive. In that case, there was a fee provision in the statute which the plaintiff could have utilized after winning the substance of the case. They waited too long, so they filed a separate cause of action. And this court said, you can't do that. You had to file in the case in which the original case, not a separate case. What was that all about? It was because the provision for attorney's fees did not create a cause of action, separate cause of action. It did not create subject matter jurisdiction to file a new case. And therefore, that case was dismissed as being untimely. Now, as to, and let's say under, as to an individual, as to showing which particular individual said yes, keep demanding, in the department, said yes, keep demanding the documents, Leetaro said that we can sue the department as the defendant. It would certainly seem, therefore, that we don't have to say who in the department did it as long as the department violated the statute, since they're a proper defendant. And again, I stress, they didn't appeal any of this. And this is not a matter of sovereign immunity. This is a pleadings issue and a proof issue, which is they have long since waived and actually are barred at this point because they didn't include it in the appeal. As to the language of the statute, which is the second reason we're entitled to fees. One is we don't have to establish both. We're entitled to fees if either we're entitled to it as ancillary attorney's fees for violation of the statute. And I frankly don't understand the all counsel's argument that, well, it's just optional. Yes, we didn't have to ask for it, but it being optional doesn't deprive us of the right to ask for it. Second and separately, we can be entitled, and we win if you accept either of these arguments. We win because the statute waived sovereign immunity. Now, why do I say that in light of prior decisions? And I'll address one of them. The Walker case, which they cited. Walker, in its statute about interest and cost, said just because the word any is used here in this statute that's not in and of itself sufficient. Now, let's keep in mind, there was ancillary relief was not involved. The statute itself was cost and post-judgment interest. So ancillary had nothing to do with it. Okay, what we learned from that is in a general statute, a simple use of the word any does not waive sovereign immunity. I accept that. That was your ruling. Of course I accept it. But here, it's different. It's different because the section that counsel, in the statute that counsel did not mention when he talked to you, the substantive portion of the statute, which says that these therapist notes are privileged in any administrative, legislative, or judicial proceeding or proceedings preliminary thereto. I submit to you that, and it said any there, that is a reference to state proceedings. And they didn't, if it wasn't a reference to state proceedings, they should have been arguing the documents weren't privileged in this case. They acknowledged finally the documents are privileged in this case. That means that the department was bound by the substantive law in the statute that in any administrative, etc. proceeding, the documents are privileged. So that's a reference to the state of Illinois in the statute. Any administrative, legislative, or judicial proceeding, because obviously a great number of those proceedings are proceedings by the state. The statute then goes further in its use of the word any. It reiterates any a total of three times. And that makes it different than the other cases in which just the simple general statement, any person, is insufficient. Because here you have a reference that includes a multitude of state proceedings, and you have an emphasis on the use of the word any.
May I ask a couple questions? It's
please.
Walker certainly is a case that you've mentioned that plays out, and obviously Lee Taru does too. In Walker, there was some discussion really trying to figure out what is this lawsuit about, and is this the type of lawsuit that falls within this sovereign immunity, or is it something else? And there's a talk in that case and some others about that certainly there's no bar, no sovereign immunity bar, for someone to bring a claim against the state, the department, where the relief requested is enjoining future conduct. And the court in Walker, I think, is trying to draw a line about, okay, enjoining future conduct, that can go forward. But whether some kind of remedy, the lawsuit is asking for some kind of remedy for past conduct, then that is barred by sovereign immunity. Is that a fair statement of how some of these cases look at it? Is this prospective, or are we looking back for some kind of damages or remedy in the past?
We're looking, certainly I'll call it, instead of officer's suit exception, I'll call it the prospective relief exception. So, yes, and here the prospective relief was we obtained a protective order and a declaratory judgment saying, not only saying that these are protected, saying that the administrative action shall treat these as privileged documents and period. So that was the future prospective relief that we obtained. And this then goes back to attorney's fees for ancillary relief. Of course, attorney's fees are not prospective relief, but they arise from the prospective relief that was granted through the protective order and the declaratory judgment that we obtained. If we had only sought money damages, this case, substantively, we would we would not be here for a number of reasons. We didn't seek money damages. Attorney's fees are not money damages for a violation of the statute. I hope I've answered your question, Your Honor.
So that's the area that I was asking you to talk about, yes.
Anything
else, sir? Yes. You can bring remarks to a clause. You certainly can respond.
Yes, just because I kind of stumbled on the other any's. In that second statute, to emphasize it's any person aggrieved by a violation of this act. And then it goes, fees and costs may be awarded to the successful plaintiff in any action. My point is that when the legislature emphasizes the all-encompassing nature of what it is providing for by saying any three times, and there's a reference to state proceedings, a reference that they never challenge in this case, that's different than the Walker case.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honors, it's not unlawful, ultra vires, or wrongful for an ALJ to rule in favor of one party and against another party, and maybe later be reversed by a court, or for a judge to do that. And it's also not ultra vires for an attorney to doggedly or zealously represent her client and vindicate that client's rights, even if that attorney or that ALJ has contravened policy or gotten the law wrong. In this court's recent 2025 Walker decision, as opposed to the one that my colleague was mentioning, it held that not every type of wrongdoing invokes the officer suit exception. Now, counsel still won't say exactly who the wrongdoer is. We're hearing about the department, or maybe somebody in the department or the attorney in the department, illustrating the futility of a remand for repleting. But the rule that he is arguing for, that the plaintiffs are arguing for, is unwarranted, it's unsupported, and it will undermine attorneys' abilities to zealously represent their clients, because it won't go so far as to criminalize representation, but it will chill it, and it will put attorneys in the position of being subject to acting wrongfully or ultra vires or beyond the scope of their authority simply by defending their clients. The Rodriguez case that was mentioned is completely distinguishable from the situation here because it involved the Administrative Procedures Act, which, as the appellate court in Schaff made clear, and this court's holdings do as well, applies only against the state. And so when you prevail under the Administrative Procedures Act and have a regulation declared unconstitutional, attorney's fees follow. Only the state passes and oversees regulations. Rodriguez is inapposite. Council mentioned would it have mattered if we just threw in the department on the caption? It wouldn't have made any bit of a difference. But it is all the difference here under this court's sovereign immunity precepts, where form and substance matter. If you had named an individual beside the department, is what he said, to correct what I stated. Yes, it was necessary to name an individual who is the wrongdoer under the officer suit exception. On the question of Walker from prior to 2025, from years ago, in re special education of Walker, the court rejected the very argument that is being asserted this morning about the word any in the statute, meaning that you can prevail against anyone, a municipality, a village, the state, because any is in there. That does not comport, again, with the types of provisions that I mentioned earlier, the Illinois Educational Labor Relations Board Act and the Illinois Toll Highway Authority Act, where the legislature knows what it's doing and states explicitly in unambiguous terms that it intends to waive sovereign immunity. So, and any, the word any, which appears in a different provision outside of Section 15, does not follow, looking at that language in a different provision, doesn't follow this court's requirement in recent Walker and other decisions, that the language itself, not a general kind of statutory gestalt, it is what the court looks at to find the General Assembly's waiver of sovereign immunity. As to the point that the statute mentions any legislative, any judicial or administrative proceeding, and therefore it's state action. Well, you can't have an administrative proceeding without the state. It's only a state ALJ who is being asked to decide questions like the one at issue here. But there are certainly proceedings that could have, that could occur under the Confidentiality Act involving, say, a husband and wife or two spouses arguing over a psychiatrist's notes. Those are two private parties going before the state. It's not, it doesn't mean that we have a waiver of sovereign immunity, because the word state is mentioned elsewhere in the provision. Your Honors, we stand on our briefs on the tolerant, unless there are any questions. And I would be remiss, because my client, Ms. Glucker, is in the courtroom today. I've never met him face-to-face, if I didn't mention that going to the Court of Claims would have been an option, conceivably, for plaintiffs had they done so in a timely fashion. The record does not disclose if they avail themselves of that opportunity. There are statutes of limitations, of course, so I say this with that caveat. And if the court has no further questions, we ask you to reverse the appellate court and hold that sovereign immunity precluded plaintiffs from obtaining attorney fees under the Act. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. This is agenda number 8, number 130033. Terrence Lowry versus the Department of Financial and Professional Regulation. This case will be taken under advisement, and thank you both for your argument.